Hey, good evening, everybody. It's Jim Hoffman here from EMS Office Hours, and I want to welcome you, of course, to a live session if you're listening to the recording. Thanks for listening, and of course, feel free to comment in the comment areas below the post here. I'd love to hear what you think about the podcast and even your feedback and maybe some things that you thought of that we didn't mention during the podcast as well. It would be great to hear that from you. We're going to be having our primary guest tonight is Mark Albert, and he's a pharmacist with New York City REMAC, and going to talk about the mnemonic sample, and we all kind of just run through that a lot of times during testing and don't really focus a lot sometimes on the importance of each individual part of sample. And we're going to break that down a little bit, but focus more on the M, or the medications part of that. And I think Mark's got some great insight on that and to how that can be very important. Real quick, though, before we start tonight, just want to mention a new website which can be helpful if you are a person who tweets. Twitter is a very popular social media venue. A lot of people are on Twitter. Maybe you're on there, you've got a couple of hundred followers, or maybe you're lucky enough to be like Charlie Sheen and have a million or so followers. But I have this site. It's called emstweetables.com. And it's kind of like a portal for all kinds of EMS stuff that if you are on, in EMS and you're trying to think of stuff to tweet and stuff that you can go ahead and make interesting to your followers, this site can be helpful because it's kind of a portal that has all the popular things that are going on in EMS pretty much from the different EMS websites, blogs, podcasts, even things like job listings and stuff like that, which is all great stuff that you can tweet and let your followers know about and be informative. So even if you know about some of the stuff you might see over at emstweetables.com, maybe there's some stuff that your followers don't know about that might help them in the day-to-day activities, or just that they might find interesting as far as EMS news and stuff that's going on out there. And in addition to the section there as well that allows for just general type of popular topics going on the web in general, stuff on Google and TMZ and all that good stuff. So kind of follows along the lines of the stufftotweet.com, but it's really focused more towards just EMS-related stuff. So that's at emstweetables.com. Of course, the link below will be available, so you can go check that out. And you can also follow them at Twitter at emstweetables.com, or emstweetables is the Twitter name. So you'll be more than happy to go ahead and do that. So let me go ahead and bring in Mark real quick, and I think we've also got Russell on the line as well from Hybrid Medic. Guys, are you on the line?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, Mark Albert.
Hey, Mark. Thanks, Russ, for joining in. I did a little quick intro a little bit, Mark, just kind of talking a little bit what we want to discuss tonight. You know, the whole thing with sample. You do the signs and symptoms and the allergies and medications and pertinent history and last meal, a drink, and events leading up to the episode and all. But sometimes when we go through this, when we're doing our patient assessments and we're going through the even with just testing or even on the scene with patients, you kind of rush through it, and maybe you don't spend as much time on some of these areas as you should. And one thing that I think is important, and this is something I think that a lot of people in EMS do, you kind of glance over the medication part. A lot of paramedics and EMTs don't like to talk about medications, don't find it interesting enough, and don't focus a lot on the medication. So what I want to talk about, the medications, it's important to know what they're currently taking, is prescribed over the counter, if it's recreational, maybe names of the medications, dosages, frequencies, why they're taking it. And this is where I think, Mark, we're going to focus a little bit on is the why they're taking it part, right?
Right, exactly.
go ahead.
Okay. Well, basically, for those of you who don't know, I have participated before. I have to give a disclaimer that I am a non-paid pharmacy consultant for New York City REMSCO Protocol Committee, but everything I'm saying tonight is really based on my opinions and nothing with my association with REMSCO. And I'm also involved in, formerly now been appointed a instructor of pharmacology at St. John's University EMS Institute. And I just recently joined the blog world of EMS MedRx, where I'm trying to bring in different topics that are contemporary and open up everybody's eyes about what seems to be the forgotten thing in terms of pharmacology and how critical it is, because we're bringing out a lot new medications and there's a lot more things that are being treated that can be treated before. And I want to start off as saying that it's definitely a challenge of getting a medication history because of the way people have a tendency to mix up medications. You know, the pill boxes are great concepts in terms of promoter compliance, but when it comes time to emergency room or emergency personnel such as EMT paramedics to try to ascertain what medications they are on, and a lot of times patients, even when they come in and we do these informal brown bag sessions in pharmacy settings that I work in, it's amazing about the amount of medications that they have there, and they just seem to store it forever and ever. Even if you look in a refrigerator, some of the reconstituted antibiotics are not even good more than 2 weeks, and they're still laying there. So, you know, we try to do as good as we can upon counseling as a, from a pharmaceutical perspective. But one of the things that a lot of EMT medics may not know that I think that is very helpful in terms of pill identification, where you come into situations where you're not sure what it is and you really want to find out, is utilizing the Poison Control Center. They do have a database. However, which has been reported recently in a lot of different blogs, and I know Tim has done a lot in the Rogue Medic, there's a lot of funding being taken away, and we're looking to have a lot of them probably close down or have moderate the hours modified. With that being said, there's a lot of things that maybe if you go to Droid Medic, he might be better to tell you some of the things, but there's a lot of free applications that you could put on your Droid and iPhone where you could put in the tablet dimensions and the colors, and it could tell you pretty much 90% or so what type of medication it is.
Yeah.
I'm just going to go over very briefly some of the things that I thought that are very important. And it's not an all-inclusive type of thing, but in some of the protocols or in some of the things that you may do, regardless of where you're practicing, a lot of times in some of the common calls that you may be coming for out dispatched for, such as asthmatics, you know, by really getting the medication history and finding out, you know, are they using a nebulizer? Sometimes people don't even understand the terminology of nebulizer, and you have to be careful of how you're asking them. You know, are you using it? Is it albuterol or anything? Because these are kind of predicate. What is your next step? Are you going to repeat doing those two or three doses of albuterol? Are you going to jump ahead and just do epinephrine, a corticosteroid, and maybe even think of intubation and exsulfate? You know, those are something. Same thing with furosemide, although in New York City we took it away from our APA protocol and made it med control option. Somebody's already on 40 milligrams. It's important to know that because it's, they're not going to respond to you know, a type of intravenous or type of dose of 40. You're going to have to double the dose really to get any diuresis. One big thing that may be overlooked is patients that are on beta blockers, and then you have to give them epinephrine, whether it's for, you know, any type of anaphylaxis. You know, it may not respond at the normal doses because of a lot of these receptors are being blocked. And sometimes some of the things that, and I'll get into it later next month when I'm going to be doing some lectures in the boot camps, there's other things that one could do in terms of adding glucagon on. But it's important, really, to know, you know, is the patient on a beta blocker, and make sure that you know all the things that atenolol and propofol are beta blockers. And more importantly, there's so many combination of medications that may actually contain a beta blocker or a diuretic in there, and it's hard to really tell. Medications that have anything with HCT almost always means that it has a diuretic of hydrochlorothiazide. So you have to be cognizant. There's a lot of medications that have combinations to patients that are on tricyclics are not used as much now, because now with the SSRIs, a lot of people are on Lexapro and Prozac and stuff like that. But, you know, they still have patients out there who are taking amitriptyline. If you didn't know that they're on it, it could be the reason why they're getting VTAC, you know, and they cause a lot of different arrhythmias. Same thing on the ground of the beta blockers, you know. You would like to know if they are taking beta blockers and they have a tachycardia, especially a sinus tachycardia, when did they take their last dose? Because the receptors, which are not lock and key like many of you might have learned, it's really three-dimensional. If they start getting released and you have an oversaturation of all those beta 1 and beta 2s going around, you're going to have all this rebound hypertension and tachycardia. So it's very important to, you know, realize and to know all those things. And I think, Jim, what you were talking about is OTC. And this is something that the FDA has given a big focus on. There's a lot of contention that it's, you know, over-the-counter. But, you know, then again, you know, we have a lot of things that recently became over-the-counter right now that could cause a lot of problems, and or simplistic things that have been out there that are very problematic. I mean, if somebody's taking enough ibuprofen and they're on a prednisone regimen, and you add along an aspirin and Plavix, and also Plavix should also key you when you're doing your medical history, that there's a good potential that the person has a stent. Almost 90% of patients who are on Plavix have some type of stent. And they may not know how to advocate it. They may not be able to say it. They may not want to be able to say it in front of the people that they're from, that you have to be conscious about. But it could give you a good idea by looking at some of the meds. And
yeah, you know, Mark, just one thing I want to mention, too, is, you know, it's hard for us as providers sometimes to remember all of the indications, contraindications for every med that's out there for a patient to take. And, you know, some protocols that we run with do give us warnings when it comes to certain medications. You know, be careful if the patient's on this medication when you give, you know, something that's in the protocol. And that's helpful to us. But like you said, there are things out there that we can use. There's apps out there that we can try to rely on, you know, for your iPhone, your Droid, and stuff like that, that can kind of help you along as you're doing it. Russ, do you use anything at all in your day-to-day activities that kind of keeps you on track with that?
As far as medication reactions and
yeah,
stuff
like
that?
You know, if somebody's taking something and it's like they're presenting a little weird and you see a medication they're on, do you try to bounce that off of anything to see if maybe that might be the reason why it's causing an issue or to warn you of maybe something you're going to give?
A few times that I can immediately recall, and one of them I turned into a case study a few months ago about, I guess it was EPS, extrapyramidal
okay.
symptoms. And they had one of those old style, I call it old style antiemetics that causes those reactions. And I was looking at they got it prescribed. It was a 16-year-old girl that it was prescribed to for flu symptoms. And I'm looking at the bottle like, man, this isn't right. So I didn't have the option at the time, but I went back and looked at it as we were headed back to the station on the cell phone. I'm like, oh, well, that's, you know, going to cause that kind of stuff. I wish I'd have known that. I could have fixed it sooner. But, yeah.
I think I know what you're talking about. I'm sorry to interrupt. I think, you know, the medications, probably the metoclopramide, could cause a lot of, you know, acute type of dystonias and type of reactions like that, that probably what most medics are equipped with is probably the diphenhydramine,
yeah.
which would probably remedy the situation. But I think it's an area that there's a need of a lot of education out there, but, you know, it can't be all-inclusive because obviously there's so many. But there's, unfortunately, medication, adverse drug reactions and med errors and being many drugs are coming out so new, and you know they're seeing now more different cross section of population, and you know there's a big thing now with the whole QTC interval prolongations with a lot of the fluoroquinolones, which are the cipros and the levaquins, and a lot of interactions, and it's good to know And I'm hoping to get that out on my blog, a list of some of those drugs and some of those interactions, because
hey,
those,
Mark, let me just bring, I think Tim might be on the line, and I think we got Josh too, so I just want to get them and give them
sure.
a chance to get in here.
Sure.
Tim, is that you on the line holding on for us?
Yeah, I was Thank not you. Able to get through on Skype. My computer is acting up on me.
I got it.
It could have been Compazine that he was that the patient was taking also, because it's not used much anymore, but it can be used as an anti-nausea drug, and it does cause dystonic reactions.
Tim, you're getting a lot of feedback.
Yeah, guys, just make sure when you're calling, you have your speakers on your computer down, because otherwise you get the feedback onto the inside the show.
There we go.
Hey,
that's a little
hey Jimmy,
yeah, I'm just
on
my phone.
Yeah, Josh, you're live as well. Thanks for dropping in.
All right, thanks for having me. Hey, guys, how you all doing?
Okay, how are you, Josh?
Tim, how you doing? I'm sorry, you can finish your thought. I think you're all right now.
I was just saying that it also produces dystonic reaction, and it's one of the things that has so many different names that we get confused about it as, we said extrapyramidal symptoms, acute dystonic reaction, decussating of the pyramids. You know, you'll hear all these different things depending upon the person you're talking to. The most common drug we see that with is Haldol.
Yeah, I've seen that
anytime,
before, too.
Yeah, they're tachycardic. They get a little bit of tightness in the neck, twisting of the neck, some swelling of the tongue, and they're feeling weird. And they're often taking drugs that we're not familiar with, because Haldol is given to people who are more than your usual behavioral problems.
Yeah. A little bit on the next level, I guess.
It was prochlorperazine is what they were on.
That's Compazine.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So, I mean, what do you guys suggest as field providers? I mean, what can we do, you think, besides educating ourselves? I mean, it's again, it's a lot to remember and a lot to try to retain when you don't come across these types of things on a day-to-day basis. You know, what can we do to maybe keep us on track and not get blindsided by just rattling off a patient's meds and just documenting it and moving on, and rather than, you know, thinking about, like you said, Tim, you know, things that could be going on because of a medication that maybe we're not really aware of?
Well, first question is, have any medications been changed recently? That is usually the easiest way to find out, is there something that is a medication reaction? Either the dose has been changed or a medication has been switched. And while it's overly simplistic, if you focus on that, usually that will be the cause of the problem.
Right.
You know, you have another point, and it goes along with just our general patient care, is that we're trying to be detectives, and so we have to ask the unusual questions. I think, you know, what medications have you started or stopped should be a standard when you're taking a patient history. Another one, and I've worked in an area where there's a good deal of sort of cultural medications and herbal medications, and they can have a big effect, is, you know, are you taking any herbal remedies? Is anybody giving you anything? Or is somebody giving you their medication that you decided to try?
And one of the big problems with the herbal medication is the potency is completely unknown. The contents are usually also unknown. People say, oh, well, I'm taking it because it's all natural. Like, cyanide's all natural. Botulism's all natural. These things will kill you faster than just about anything that's man-made.
Yo, there are a lot of, I mean, there are some medications, St. John's wort. If you report that you've taken St. John's wort, they'll delay surgery because you have a propensity for bleeding. So there's, you know,
they take that, like, Prozac.
Yeah, and I mean, exactly. And you think about it, it's like, where did our medicines come from? I mean, majority of our medicines, well, this would be a number out my butt, but I was about to say majority of our medicines come from man-made sources now. But I know that there's a significant number of our medicines and the roots of all our medicines were natural sources. I mean, you know, you think of digitalis.
Aspirin.
Aspirin, yeah. Right.
Well, you know? Dig is going away these days. How many times do you see a patient on Dig anymore?
They have that synthetic stuff now, and mm-hmm. The name escapes me. But yeah, you're 100% right, unfortunately. And I don't even know if that's a good thing or not.
Well, back in 99, 2000, something like that, there was a study that looked at patients who were on chronic Dig and found, I forget which it was, whether the patients on Dig had a higher life expectancy, more hospitalizations, or the patients off Dig lived longer but were in the hospital more. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that says, what's the point?
Yeah, I mean, it used to be the cornerstone of CHF, but, you know, really, because it's a drug that we call a very narrow therapeutic level, in other words, the level from being therapeutic and toxic is so narrow, and, you know, and some of the, and, you know, we have very few patients, but, you know, one of the things to be keen on, and I'd be remiss if I didn't indicate it, you know, patients have an anorexia that are on digitalis or actually seeing the halos. You know, you hear about those things, but it's more other treatments right now that they're using. They're using this alpha beta blocker combined with Coreg, Carvedilol, and a lot of diuretics, and they're really staying around. You'll see some of the older people that they just are maintaining on it, but they're just really not out there. But you're right, there's a lot of dependent on different parts of New York or even around the country, that there's a lot of ethnic things, and it's just a disaster when people come into the pharmacy and you see what they have in the vial. It's not even the medication that's labeled.
So I have a question, you know, for you guys. When you're in the field and you're assessing a patient, how many of you guys count pills? You know,
depends on what the things are. Half the time they've got over a dozen different bottles, and how much time are you going to take to actually, you know, just figure out how many should be in there and does it look like the right amount are in there? If there's a report of a possible overdose, definitely.
Right. But if you're...
Do we even know what the pills are supposed to look like? Maybe they refilled it with aspirin.
Oh, Lord. Yeah. And that happens too. Right.
Yeah, it happens. I think, I don't know if you heard me early in the, you know, a lot of these pill boxes are great and conducive for compliance aids, but that's another thing for a disaster for emergency personnel. And then there's another
right.
problem
what
that's going on
here. What medicine do you take, ma'am? Here you go.
Yeah. No, there's another thing, too, that we're contending with, too, that I have to let you know. You know, there's definitely a big, as you know, a big language barrier. And we're getting a lot of pressure that things need to be labeled, whether in Spanish or other languages. But if you're a healthcare professional or EMS professional in the field, then you can't read the directions. So the State Board of Pharmacy is saying, well, then you have to do both languages, because if an EMS personnel doesn't know how to read the Spanish and doesn't know what the directions are, you have a serious problem. But I would venture to say that if you're not sure – and you think that the patients could be admitted, you know, maybe have a plastic bag and just throw everything in there and just take it to the hospital. And let because most of the hospitals are required by Joint Commission to do a medication reconciliation where they see what the patient's presently on and then make sure that there's continuity of care, because there's certain agents that you just can't let them, as I alluded to, the beta blockers and some of the other medications, that you just can't let them go cold turkey. So maybe the best way to handle that is you go into a situation where you see a whole bunch of bottles, you have a time element, and that's not just the only thing you're looking at, obviously, in sample and your assessments and what other care you have to be rendered. It's just kind of take it and run, unless you're in a situation, which I'll get into in the boot camp, where we're going to talk a little bit more and focus on doing the H&Ts, and you're trying to look at to see why is this person in cardiac and pericardiac arrest, and what are some of the medications that may be implicated in there. And in that case, you may have a team of people where they could do a little scouting and looking around the house and the medicine cabinets and see if they could find things and see what's going on. So that's something later on that I could give some tips and some ideas of some of the problematic drugs that are implicated in the H&Ts.
What about as far as listening to the patients? I mean, how much do you think we should be, you know, taking stock in that? I know we just mentioned earlier about how they talk about how they're taking an herbal remedy or something like that, and they don't think there's any issue with it. I mean, you know, should we be listening to them with their RX meds and what they feel, why they're taking it? You know, some people will say, I'm taking one thing, you know, for a certain illness, but in your mind, you're thinking that, well, that's not for that. That's for something else. I mean, should we be listening to the patients?
A lot of times they think it's for one thing, and they'll have them mixed up. My father used to do that all the time, and he knew the medications he was taking. He'd just get confused about which one was for which illness. And that's not necessarily a problem as long as you're getting the right information from them. And
yeah,
sometimes you get the patient telling you something that's not in the bag that you didn't look for, like the insulin in the refrigerator.
Right. Right, absolutely. But Mark sort of touched on this before with Digitalis, and he was talking about anorexic patients, but I think, Tim, you sort of referenced it right now with some of our geriatric patients. You know, overdose can be there, so we need to know some of these drugs that can be toxic because on their normal regimen, they might have thought that they took it, or forgot they took it, and now they're taking it a second time.
Yeah, all the sedative medications are ones where you want to think about that. Anything that affects blood pressure.
Well, yeah, yeah.
That'll affect circulation to the brain.
I had a guy last week forget that he took his insulin and then decided to take it again. So that's a good thing that needs to be queried about is have you taken too much of your insulin, of course, after you wake them up. But
right, yeah.
Sometimes a family will say, I didn't see him take his insulin this morning, so I told him to take it again. Oh, awesome.
Yeah, I've had him where he passed out, and we couldn't find a pulse on him, so we were forcing some nitro into his mouth.
Yeah, but well, that's why I was saying, too, before about the medication. It's not just about asking the medicine and then having to rattle off or handing you a bag of meds or whatever. It's important to know, again, you know, the what they think they're taking it for, the dosage and frequency, why they're taking it, the last time they took it. You know, all this should be part of the M when you get to that part of your assessment is to get all that information because maybe it might not tie in to your initial assessment, but maybe down the line – for the docs, or they're putting stuff together, you know, as far as the whole, you know, again, like you said, Josh, about being detectives, you know, maybe it could tie in to what might be actually going on with the patient that we're not being able to see out in the field.
So here's the million-dollar question, Jim. Is this going to change how we treat our patient in the field? You're sitting there and you're looking at somebody and they're AMS. Are you going to withhold something because you think that they may have overdosed on their pain meds or, you know, the fentanyl patch and the hydrocodone maybe were a little too much? Or are you going to treat them as an AMS? That's sort of a rhetorical question. I mean, of course we're going to treat them, but, you know
Josh, you asked
actually
a lot of million-dollar questions.
Depends on how they present. If I've got somebody who's breathing adequately but got an altered mental status and they've got fentanyl and they've got a bunch of other opioids on board, I'm not giving them Narcan. Who knows how much pain I'm going to cause them by reversing the opioids they've got on board. As long as they're breathing, that's all that I need. I can bring them to the hospital, make sure their airway is protected, make sure they have good circulation, and let them figure out why they've got altered mental status. Because a lot of times, it's not due to the pain medicine. And once you start reversing that with Narcan, then you really complicate things. What do you do to control the pain then?
Well,
if they're already tolerant. you know, if they're already tolerant to this, are you going to give them 300, 400, 500 micrograms of fentanyl or 30, 40, 50 milligrams of morphine to get them back to a not extreme pain state after you reverse all the high doses of opioid that they're taking? Nobody
well,
that I know of is going to do that, and that's just torturing the patient.
You're 100% correct and in logic. But, you know, this sort of throws us back to Jim's last week topic of, you know, 5 cc's of care. You know, how much of it is going to be CYA? Now, are you going to test some of that or are you just going to outwardly say, no, doc, I didn't give him, even though he's AMS, I didn't give him any Narcan, even though I was supposed to? I mean, that's...
Well, call him up and tell him, this is what's going on. This is why I don't want to give Narcan. And... Docs are often reasonable people. They've been to medical school. They understand about the drug interactions in most cases. I've run into some who don't want to hear about it, say just follow the protocol. But my protocols, fortunately, in Pennsylvania, say that I do not need to follow the protocol if I think that this will lead to a worse outcome for the patient, because clearly protocols do not cover every possible situation.
Well, I think
and
you also
any protocol that doesn't include that kind of line really isn't a good protocol.
You also
so,
okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
You know, so I'm willing to debate that with the doctor at the hospital, debate that with my medical director, but how can I say, okay, I'm going to automatically Dr. Bledsoe wrote a paper called No More Comat Cocktails back a few years ago. I think it was 2002, 2003.
Right.
And it's available at his website.
Mm-hmm.
And this reflective, just give the antidote because we can thing is not necessarily a good idea. Is the altered mental status due to the medication that I have the reversal agent for, or is it due to something else? If I'm giving something just because I have a reversal agent, isn't it like the drunk looking for his keys underneath the light because the light is better there, even though he lost his keys halfway down the block?
I completely agree, and in defense of the way that you're making this phrasing this argument is that you started out with the caveat if they were breathing adequately, and I agree with that
yes.
wholeheartedly. I mean, how often do we come across end-stage patients who are on a host of meds that would kill an ordinary, you know, person, and they're taking them, you know, 3 times a day, and yeah, right now things have caught up. Maybe there's an infection. Maybe there's another root cause that's not going to be corrected by reversing the opioids, and there's no reason to do so if they're breathing adequately. If they're maintaining, there's no reason. I mean, but,
and
you know, and
I did see one case. Go ahead.
I was thinking in my mind, not necessarily, and you brought up the pain medication. That is important. I was thinking in my mind, if you got somebody and they're a solid SVT, would you sit there and not go through the procedure to try to reverse that condition based on the idea that you see a med that might have caused this? You know,
well, if they're taking aminophylline or any of the derivatives of aminophylline, that might be a contraindication, or you might need to actually, not contraindication, give more of the adenosine to get the rhythm to break.
But I think you've made the best statement of the night, which is, hey, if you're in doubt, you have a doctor on the line. Give them a call. That's what they're there for.
Yeah, I think they shouldn't be there for permission to do things, but they're always there for permission to not do things that are seen as standard in the protocols. When you see something that is unusual, the smart thing to do is to call up the doctor and say, hey, this is not something I'm familiar with. We're trained to do a few things very well, and some of us don't even do that, but we need to recognize and we need to recognize once we get outside of that area. And when we get outside of that area, the thing to do is call command and say, hey, this is what I'm looking at. Is this something where I need to do something for the patient right now, or would you like to have you transport the patient, and as long as they remain otherwise stable, you'll see them, be able to fully assess them, draw a red top tube, and send that off for a blood level, because almost all of the drug levels come out of the plain sterile tube, and they have something to work on. Some of the drug levels come back quickly, some do not, because you know, whenever they do an autopsy, they say it'll be a couple weeks before they have the drug results back. You know,
right,
you do get
right.
some of them back quickly. And some of the right. drugs, other than DIG, have narrow therapeutic window. We give lidocaine, and that has a very narrow therapeutic window, and when you get high on the level of lidocaine, you can cause seizures. And we forget about that. Yet we automatically give it, if you're in a place that does RSI, we automatically give it to people with head injuries prior to RSI. Like, okay, can cause seizures, and we're giving it to people with head injuries. Not the best idea.
Mark, you chime in on that one?
Yeah, and, you know, it goes back to about talking a little bit about, you know, this whole concept. Well, we do something we have an antidote about. I mean, we were deliberating about, you know, everybody these days are on the benzodiazepines. They're taking lorazepam, and they get a little bit depressed, and they want to overdose. But it goes back to the same thing. You know, the cure is almost worse than the actual disease itself. I mean, the romazepam, which, you know, is supposed to reverse it, causes seizures. And the biggest crux of the problem of a benzodiazepam overdose is the whole thing with the airway management. So imagine you having somebody in the back of the bus, and you give them the romazepam to try to reverse it, and they start seizing, and you have to maintain the airways. And that's just it's not a very good way to go. So, you know, about the therapeutic intervals and stuff like that, yeah, there's plenty of drugs out there. Tim touched on one about the theophylline, which is not too much used because they recognize that asthma is more a inflammatory disease, and you don't need these xanthine inhibitors to go through a different cascade in the body, thank God, but has a very narrow between 10 and 20. So 10 and 20 and so many drug interactions could push it, you know, over the range where it gets toxic, and you have so many, you know, terrible things that occur. But I think it goes back to me where I'm trying to learn 12 leads and stuff. And I had the question that I asked to Tom from 12 leads, like, you know, it may have sounded ignorant, but it was like, why does a medic really have to know these things if they're going to be transported to the hospital? And I think the more knowledge you have and the more better you know about the patient, it's better patient care. And I think this goes back a little bit to the medications. Yeah, it's not. It may not change what's going to be your plan of action depending on where they're in, whether they have to have the airway management, whether they, you know, sometimes with the hospice situations, the goal is, you know, they're going to die anyhow. You want them to have very low respiration rates anyhow. So, you know, to panic, and I totally agree with Tim because we had this conversation. It's almost mentally cruel to reverse them so abruptly and then have them have violent reactions, and then what do you do? But I think it's just an important thing for everybody and medics and EMT at least to have a feel or have the resources how to look up. And that's why I'm kind of dedicated to getting involved in this and at least try to give what is the nuts and bolts of the most important ones that are out there, at least have people more conscious about it. And it's not a perfect world. We're not going to, you know, you're going to go in the house and it's not going to be on the top of the list, but and it's going to be hard to really get that type of history, but we can't totally blow it off. It's got to be some attempt that's got to be made to it, and I can't be just being a pharmacist saying that everything is attributable. You know, it's a very good question to ask, what is new in your regimen, because if somebody all of a sudden has some angioedema and they just started some new medication, you know, that's a very good chance that that's what's happening. And is it going to change the way you're going to do things? Probably not, but it's good for you as the practicing medic or EMT to really have a good idea of what's going and at least hand that off to the triage nurse and to the doctors and say, look, I'm not sure, but these are the things that are occurring, and this is the background. This is potential things. Now it's up to you as the diagnosticians and to do more deep things to rule in and rule out. And,
hey,
and
Mark,
that's pretty much, yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and put a link to your blog up on the show notes. We're just about out of time, so I just want to give everybody a chance to just maybe give some last-minute thoughts before we end out. We got maybe 3 minutes left. So, Russ, any last-minute thoughts before we sign off?
Getting patients medications are important. And they offer a lot of clues towards patient history that sometimes the patients or their family themselves may not know.
Yeah, exactly. Good point. Tim, anything? Any final thoughts real quick before we sign off?
Well, we all need to know more about pharmacology.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why I keep the past week or so, since Mark started his blog, I keep linking to it to get people to go there and read. It's a new blog, and he's developing content, but he's going to be presenting the information that is more in-depth than what we got in med class or what we get in our con ed classes.
Sure.
This is stuff we need to know.
Absolutely. Josh, what about you? I think you said
absolutely.
About everything, but
you know, I'll build on what Tim is saying, and this goes to another topic. The biggest insult you can say to somebody in the field is you're an ambulance driver. If we truly do not want to be perceived as just ambulance drivers when we walk into that ED, then let's have a full history. Let's have a complete history. Let's have a possibility of what we think is wrong here with the patient, and we'll be perceived in the medical community as knowing more, as a little bit higher standing.
Sure. All right, guys, I'm going to put everybody's, of course, blogs and some of the links we talked about, Russell's case study he did, and I'm going to look up Dr. Bledsoe's article as well and get that on the show notes as well, so any listeners can go check out those resources. And, of course, I recommend, of course, checking out Tim's blog or RogueMedic.com, and Russell's at Hybrid Medic, and, of course, Mark, I'm going to plug you in there as well. I know you got the whole at WordPress deal, but I'll put your full link in the show notes so people can just click on it without having to remember the link, all right? Thanks again, guys, for joining me tonight. I really appreciate it. Have a great night, everybody.
Thanks. Good night.
Well, everybody, we're just about out of time tonight. I want to thank you again for joining me in this EMS Office Hours. Again, like everybody mentioned, use the resources that are available to you, whether it's educating yourself is very, very important. But, of course, you've got other resources out there, whether it's your medical control doc, maybe it's the doc at the ER, even trying to use things like your iPhone and your Droids and things like that to use as a resource to find out indications and contraindications of drugs, all great resources. And we have to keep on, learning and keep on educating ourselves through these things like these podcasts, through things like the blogs that are out there. Very important resources we can use. So thanks for joining me, everybody. Again, leave your comments below in the show notes. Love to hear what you think about the podcast. And until next week, of course, this is Jim Hoffman from EMS Office Hours. Stay safe.